Thanks, Matthias, for the introduction, and thank you for the invitation, especially Cody. So today I'll be talking about detecting heavy field beyond the Hubble scale using what we call cosmological collider program. The work is, I'll talk about two of my recent works. One is done with Shravya Kumar and Ramachandran, and one is in progress with Raman. Okay, so the outline of the talk would be as follows. I'll give a very brief introduction, mostly focusing on what is cosmological collider physics and the Boltzmann light suppression that is seen in it, which will set the stage for the later parts. The overarching theme of the talk would be how to see heavy particles during inflation, and I will describe two ways to do so. In part one, I'll talk about the chemical potential mechanism, specifically for complex scalar fields, and it's covered in this paper. And in part two, I'll talk about the ongoing work where you use classical oscillations of the heavy field instead of quantum production. And I'll end with some thoughts on some work that is still in progress. So one of the successes of inflation, one would say, is that it explains the density and isotropy through the quantum fluctuations of inflaton field. And it can be seen in a simpler way through this cartoon that I've drawn here. On the x-axis, you have a conformal time. On the y-axis, you have co-moving length scales. And the yellow line keeps track of the co-moving horizon. So if I look at a specific length, co-moving length scale, which is in the purple line, we see that at some point during the inflation, as the co-moving horizon is shrinking, this length scale will exit the horizon, which means that no causal physics can change it, and hence gets frozen. Till the time that inflation ends and the co-moving horizon starts increasing again, and it re-enters the horizon at some later time. But what that means is that the density fluctuations that we see at later times during in CMB or 21 centimeter, et cetera, they are actually seeded by these very early time quantum fluctuations at the horizon exit. So this feature of modes being frozen is quite useful because it gives us access to see physics that's happening really early in time, or in other words, really at really high energies. So if we can model the physics after the entry of horizon entry of these modes, which is mostly standard model physics, we can actually backtrack the time evolution to get information about what is affecting the quantum or the statistics of fluctuations at the horizon exit, which can be coming from some new physics which is happening sub-horizon. So this is why cosmological observations can be really powerful in probing really high energy physics that's happening during inflation. Now, one way to probe these is non-Gaussianities in the statistics of fluctuations. For example, if we take CMB, we of course talk about power spectrum, which is two-point function of the temperature fluctuations. But one could talk about higher point correlation functions like a triangle, or a four-point correlation function of these temperature fluctuations. And just as I explained, these correlations of temperature and isotropies are coming from the quantum fluctuations from the end of inflation when these modes are exiting, right? So the temperature fluctuations are mapped onto the correlations of inflaton quantum fluctuations. And generally, we talk about, it's easier to talk about, instead of the position space, to talk about Fourier space, because homogeneity and isotropy ensures that the momentum, three momentum, is conserved. So I'll mostly be talking about this K modes instead of actually talking about position space. Now, it's easier to kind of visualize these correlations in terms of diagrams. So I have drawn one here where the time is actually running upwards, and these correlations are taken. The correlations are taken at the end of inflation, which is this reheat surface, let's say. And if I'm talking about a three-point function, one can see that it's actually coming from some interactions of these fluctuations, which is happening earlier in time, and then propagating to this reheat surface where we actually measure the correlation function. Now, it's easy to now see that if you want to probe interactions, you need to look at higher point functions. The two-point functions would just scale the power spectrum and nothing more. So it can be various kinds of interaction. It could be a point-like interaction, or it could be an interaction mediated by a heavy field, which would be the focus of this talk. So it was seen in these seminal papers that you can actually do direct detection of particles with masses as heavy as the inflationary Hubble scale, which is 10 to the power 13 GeV. And hence it was dubbed as the cosmological collider. And its idea is that there is a specific non-analytic signature that gets imprinted on the three-point functions when it's mediated by a heavy particle. And it comes from literally the on-shell production during inflation, as I'll explain. And to see this, what is the signature? Let's just go back to the diagram again. And the signature generally becomes apparent in something called as a squeezed triangle configuration, where two of these correlations are close by and one is taken far away. Or in other words, two of the momenta are much higher than on the soft third momentum, which is the soft momentum. And there is a field that is propagating in between, which is heavier than the Hubble scale. And the signature in the three-point correlation function looks something like that. It has a ratio of the hard momentum to the soft momentum to some power that is non-analytic. And if you take the limit that mass is greater, much, much greater than the Hubble, it actually becomes an oscillatory dependence in this momentum ratio. And it has a frequency of mass. So if you actually see these oscillations in the in the three-point correlation, then from the frequency, you can extract the mass. So that's the direct detection part. So let's quickly try to understand the origin of this non-analytic signature, which would be helpful later on.
Sorry to interrupt you. I have a quick question. Sorry, how is the, sorry, I may have not understood it properly. Mm-hmm. So you're saying that the signal, if the mass is much larger than Hubble, the signal does not decouple?
Oh, yes. No. It would have decoupled if it was just, if it was produced like, it was like a produced and decayed quickly. Like it, but it because it's produced on shell, it can propagate longer distances and hence gives the signal.
Sorry, but if the mass is very high, how is it getting produced? I'm confused about if I send the mass to infinity, right?
Yeah,
and it's outside the spectrum, it shouldn't the signal decouple?
Yeah, there must be exponential suppression. So, didn't you write it?
Yeah, I will talk. I was just going to get to it.
No, but it's here in this formula. In front of everything, there is exponential suppression, right?
Oh, it's not here in the slide. It's just oscillatory. Because if you see, there's an I in the front.
You don't have... Yeah, this is the part that...
No, but that confuses me. Here in this formula, didn't you assume that the mass is of order Hubble, or is it valid also for mass much larger than Hubble, this formula?
It is valid for masses larger than Hubble, but there is an additional suppression factor that I haven't included here because I just wanted to focus on the non-analytic signature. I will talk about it. You're right. Like like I can make infinitely heavy masses and just get away.
Okay.
That's not gonna happen.
Thank you. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Let me just quickly point out why this signal is coming. And again, I would have expected if it's a heavy field, it would just live for a very short time, given uncertainty principle.
Sorry, I also have another, can I ask you one more thing about the dependence on M over H minus 9 forced there.
Oh yeah, so yeah. Okay, wait, sorry.
This is for the exchange of a scalar.
Oh, right.
So
right.
Delta sigma is a scalar.
Yeah, so here the sigma field I've taken as a scalar to simplify things. If you have a heavier field, you still have this factor, this oscillatory signature, but this three halves could change. Like for fermions, it's minus two, I think.
What happens, for example, if the scalar has a direct coupling to R?
Sorry, direct coupling to?
To R, to the, because it's a scalar, right? It's a singlet. Sigma mm-hmm. is a singlet. So yeah, what happens, yeah. It's out of curiosity, you don't have to have thought of it. But what happens if I have a sigma squared R coupling on top of whatever your, so how does this exponent change?
Yeah. I'm not sure, actually. I don't know if the exponent would change. I'm not sure. I'll think about it. But here it's more like a, it does, of course, couple to inciton, but the coupling is perturbative and much smaller. So these are small non-Gaussianities. Because we know that the data is, like the fluctuations or statistics is mostly Gaussian. So whatever non-Gaussianity I'm expecting is already small. So everything is treated like, I'm not sure if that.
No, it's okay. It's a tangential question of curiosity.
Okay.
Carry on, sorry. Thank you.
Okay, so as I was saying that this non-analytic signature is coming because of propagation of this heavy field. And to see it, we can draw the diagram again and we can kind of ask how much this field is propagating and how much phase it accumulates while it's propagating. So the phase it accumulates is e to the power minus I m delta t. And we want to ask how this delta t depends on the momenta that I've chosen for the in my three-point correlation function. Right? Now, in the De Sitter space, the time translation along with the spatial scaling is a symmetry. So I know that this change in time must depend on somehow the ratio of the momenta that I've chosen. And the only non-trivial ratio here is the hard momentum to soft momentum ratio. So I know that the time change must depend on this momentum ratio. And how exactly it depends actually comes from when this particle gets produced and when it gets when it decays. And there is, maybe I'll talk about it a little bit more, but essentially this time delta t actually depends logarithmically on the ratio of the momenta, which basically translates to the original signal, which was m log ratio of the momenta. And here I'm just, instead of log, I've written it in the exponential form. Let me know if there's any questions on it. But the important point is that the non-analytic signature is a result of this e to the power I m delta t propagation of the heavy field. Just as a side comment, I will be using conformal time in most of the talk and co-moving momenta unless I state that it's a physical momentum. As the questions prompted before, there is it's not like I can make really heavy particles that can get away with that because there's this huge suppression factor sitting in front of the non-analytic signature. And as you can see, if I increase mass, it exponentially the amplitude decays exponentially faster. And the quick way to understand it is like why I'm able to even make these particles is because I have a time-dependent background during inflation. And this introduces explicit time dependence in the Hamiltonian. So we know that if you have a time-dependent Hamiltonian, you can have excitations which are off the order of the time scale of change of this background, which is Hubble. So I'm allowed to make particles of order Hubble, but if I want to make anything more, I have to pay this exponential suppression price suppression. And a heuristic argument is that you can think of it like a thermal system with the temperature, which is of order Hubble. So a probability of any excitation of energy delta E would be exponentially suppressed like this. And here we're not talking about probability, but we're talking about amplitude. So we get, we actually have a square root of the probability. So we, interestingly, this heuristic argument actually gives us the exact form of this exponential suppression, which is e to the power minus pi m over h. And just as a diagrammatic way, one can say that, okay, this particle is actually coming from this background frequency of order Hubble. It's getting produced and it's decaying. But if mass is greater than Hubble, I have to pay this exponential Boltzmann-like suppression factor. What that means is that I can't go way beyond Hubble. But if I go, if I take my mass to be much smaller than Hubble, then the non-analytic signature actually disappears. So I have a very limited range of masses that would be observable before the exponential suppression kicks in and kills it. So that is the motivation. So the rest of the talk, the two parts that I'll describe, are based on this idea that how can we get rid of this Boltzmann suppression and see masses which are much heavier than Hubble. And in part one, I'll talk about the chemical potential mechanism. And it's not exactly chemical potential, it just looks like it, hence it's in quotation marks.
Yeah, may I ask one question? So
yeah.
Am I right? There is one more suppression here, the Slorell suppression also, right? If you consider the 3-point function as you do in non-Gaussianity, there is also Slorell suppression, isn't there?
Sorry, what do you mean? Do you mean the...
Well, epsilon, because well, one of phi should go to the background and that should be phi dot, I think.
Oh, yes. It's d phi dot, yeah.
So there is also epsilon in front of everything, right? Like this
parameter. Yes. Yeah, true.
Okay, thanks.
Can I ask you a couple of things? I'm not an expert on this stuff. So there's two things that I'm confused about. So first of all, I thought, so this time, this delta time thing, I'm a bit confused about. I thought that you were taking just 3-point functions in three momentum space. So time is free. It's time you haven't Fourier transformed. So why is it this ratio of momentum? Why can't you take it to be arbitrarily large or small?
Good. That's a great question. So generally, basically, when I'm actually drawing these vertices, they are actually, when you do the calculation of the 3-point function on the final surface, you are integrating over the entire time. So they can happen. So you're integrating over all the contribution that is happening, all the interactions happening in time before that surface. But it so happens that the dominant contribution comes from very specific times. And those specific times depend on what momenta I chose and what is the mass of the intermediate particle. Hence, this delta time, it's not by choice, but it just happens like that because the interactions are strongest at those times.
I see.
Okay.
Oh, sorry. In the second question that I had, that actually I forgot my second question, is that okay? You so for masses that are too small, you lose this non-analytic signature.
But yes.
Is there any other signature? Because if the mass is small, anyways, you produce a particle. So why is this non-analytic signature the only thing that you care about?
Oh yeah, I mean it's not like that's the only. I mean that's the only thing I care about because I want to see heavy masses. And if I go back to, here. So if you actually set this m over h factor to be zero, this whole thing becomes zero, in the exponent. So then there is no distinctive signature, and it could. And then there is no way to distinguish something that's mediated by a heavy field versus something that could just be a point-like interaction like here, the first one. So there's no difference between this interaction or something that is mediated by a mass.
In other words, the three-point function in all parts of parameter space, that means all combinations of momenta, the only mass dependence is in that exponent?
So there is also a mass dependence in the overall amplitude, like in the front, there's a polynomial dependence in mass. That can be absorbed in the coupling constant. Or I mean, you wouldn't be able to actually, there's no way to. Here, I think the interesting part is this momentum ratio is controlled by us as the observable. I can choose to look at the triangle configuration I want to in the sky. So if it acts like a knob. So if I change this P, I actually see oscillations, which helps me get the mass. But if I don't have such kind of knob to change, then if I just have like an overall non-Gaussianity, then there's no way to actually extract the mass. Then it would give you non-Gaussianity, but you won't be able to get the mass.
Okay. Thank you.
So as I was saying, the exponential suppression, the root cause is that the background can only provide you with Hubble frequencies, the Hubble energies. So one idea is, can we couple the heavy field to a different background source which might have higher frequency, let's say lambda, so that this production is now easier. And one place where this high frequency source will come from is the inflaton background itself. Now inflaton, the heavy field is anyway coupled to the inflaton, so it could be, and it's coupled to the inflaton background, which is actually let's say we couple it to the kinetic energy of the inflaton. It's actually much bigger than the Hubble scale, which could be, it's actually around 60 Hubbles. So if we manage to couple this heavy field to the kinetic energy and utilize that to produce these particles, then I can get away with larger masses than just staying at the Hubble level, right? So this kind of motivation was behind this chemical potential idea, and it was actually studied in the context of spin half and spin one fields before. Some people who are already in the audience. So our model is actually for complex scalar fields, and it was motivated by these previous studies, but it turned out that it's qualitatively different, and I'll talk about it later once I explain the model. So the model is quite simple. You have a complex scalar field sigma, and it has a mass which is heavier than the Hubble. And we are going to couple its current to the inflaton through this derivative interaction. And why we want to couple it through to inflaton derivatively is because we want to preserve shift symmetry of inflaton so that we don't, give corrections to the inflaton potential. And this is the simplest way to do it. And we see that this operator is actually of the form of the current being coupled to d mu 5. And if I set the inflaton to its vacuum, its wave, I see that the first part just becomes a number, and which is basically coupling, which is introducing the number density into my Lagrangian, the J0. And this has the form of the chemical potential with the parameter in the front being the chemical potential lambda. Hence, the whole model is dubbed as chemical potential. Then we can ask, how large can this lambda be? And we want to make sure that we have perturbative control, and which requires that this cutoff scale lambda has to be greater than the square root of kinetic energy of inflaton, which gives me that the lambda has to be smaller than the square root of kinetic energy, which is 60 Hubbles. This is basically what I wanted. I wanted a background source which has a higher frequency than Hubble. And let's see how it works. Just by coupling inflaton to the current, we see that it's actually not enough, because I can easily just do a field redefinition of the sigma field and get rid of this operator in the new basis. And that's because this is actually just a conserved current at this point, and it's derivatively coupled. So by partial, integration by parts, I can get rid of it. So what I need is I need to break the symmetry, the U1 symmetry of this sigma field explicitly by a small amount. And in some sense, it can be thought of as like coupling it to a thermal bath, which is when the chemical potential would make sense. Just for the isolated system, it wouldn't make sense. And now I see that if I do the same field rotation, this the dimension 5 chemical potential operator disappears, but I get this extra phase in the term that was breaking U1 symmetry. I wanted to point out that it is still maintaining shift symmetry of the inciton, because if I shift phi by a small amount and appropriately rotate sigma tilde, then that is a symmetry again, which would happen if we see where the sigma tilde is coming from in the first place. And so now, once I have this exponent, I can expand, I can break an inciton into its web and its fluctuations. And I see that I get this factor, which is which has the chemical potential. So I get fluctuations with the explicit time dependence, which has this high frequency component coming from the chemical potential. So essentially, what we have managed to do is couple this heavy field to inciton through a high frequency background source, which is coming from chemical potential, which can be as high as 60 Hubble. So we expect that the production should be now easier. Maybe I'll quickly talk about how the non-analytic signature should look like. So now I have the same diagram where the heavy field is propagating. But at each vertex, I have a chemical potential of injecting frequency of order lambda, right? So I have the phase which is accumulated through the propagation of the heavy field, but I also have phases coming from the chemical potential being at the vertices giving extra phases. So I see that my non-analytic signature is similar to the previous one, but now the frequency is M modified by the lambda as the difference between the mass and the lambda. So I would still see oscillations, but the frequency would not just depend on mass, but it will also depend on lambda. And to get the amplitude of this signature, you have to go through some lengthy calculation. I'll sketch some part of it. So these kinds of correlations are calculated in something called Inan formalism, where you start with Bunch-Davies vacuum and evolve with the interaction Hamiltonian and take correlations at the reheat time. It's very similar to the in-out formalism, but instead of doing transition amplitudes, you're actually taking correlation functions at the reheating surface. So you have in states on both sides, basically. It's called Inan formalism. At tree level, I can actually expand this exponential and kind of take as many vertices I want, depending upon which, if I'm looking at 3-point function or 4-point function. And what I would also need is how the time dependence, because I haven't Fourier transformed in time, so I need to know the time dependence of the mode functions. And it turns out it's a little complicated. It's these Bessel functions are specifically Henkel functions. And they're chosen such that at early times, they map onto the Minkowski mode functions in conformal time, so that we don't start with any particles to begin with. And we start with no particle state. Generally, the time ordering part, there's a time ordering here, and it can be quite complicated, especially for loop diagrams. But in our case, at tree level, it can be simplified with the intuition that the decay at the soft vertex is happening earlier, or the contribution in that time integral comes earlier than the decay at the hard vertex. So that actually simplifies the calculation a little bit. Just to quickly sketch out how we do it, when you're trying to calculate three-point function, in our case, we have two vertices. So they could be coming from the time-ordered part or anti-time-ordered part. And depending upon that, you have these various contributions. And if I want to sketch out one of the calculation, how it's done, you generally have, these vertices could be varied in time. So you have two time integrals at each vertex. And they generally involve integrating some complicated time dependencies with Henkel functions in them. But they have an analytic form. So I can do both time integrals at soft versus hard vertex. And they are generally come out in the form of these hypergeometric functions. There was an interesting thing here, like when we are doing this project, we had to generalize this formula for n being a complex parameter. So that was just something we faced while doing the calculation. But in short, the point is that even though it looks messy, the calculation can be done exactly in our model at tree level. And the expressions can later be simplified to study relevant limits, like the lambda and mass being much greater than Hubble, and this moment, the momentum ratio being much bigger than one, that is a squeeze limit. Okay, so let me just kind of go through the results. One quick way to tell how much non-Gaussianities has is normalize it, the three-point function by two-point functions appropriately, and break it into momentum dependence and just the strength of the non-Gaussianity, so the amplitude and the momentum dependence. And as I explained, in our case, we would get a momentum dependence with with this frequency, which is the difference of chemical potential and mass. And in the approximation where lambda is greater than the mass, we can simplify all these horrible expressions before to a very simple form, which is given parametrically by this expression. Now here, this 10 to the power minus 2 factor comes because we have to ensure that whatever model we have doesn't give too much correction to the power spectrum. So that just has to be done. And I think it's a conservative limit because it doesn't give any feature in the power spectrum, it just scales the power spectrum. So you wouldn't technically know, but still we want to maintain that it's just at 1% level to be safe. And this rest of the part is generally of order 10 or 100 for lambda of 60 Hubble and masses of maybe 10 or 15 Hubble. So we generally expect the strength of the non-Gaussianity to be around 0.1 to 10.
Yeah, excuse me. Can you explain more this bound of 10 to minus 2? Where does it come from? Not this bound, but this factor, yeah, that you have there.
Yeah, yeah. So because I have this heavy field, I can also imagine a diagram where I have a two-point function, and then there is a heavy field in between, and then there are connected to the background incitron.
Okay.
And this gives correction to the power spectrum.
Good.
So we just wanted to make sure that it doesn't give too much correction to the power spectrum, which is.
But what kind of correction? So it produces. I mean, actually, having features in the power spectrum are even more interesting, perhaps.
Yeah. Yeah. True. But true. So this actually doesn't give any. It would just scale the power spectrum. It doesn't give any.
Okay, but if it scales, then feature. It's not. Then it's not.
Yeah. So. Yeah, that's true. But we just, I don't know. We just wanted to be safe in that sense. But you can say that okay, if I want to take away this, then my non-Gaussianity just be 10 or 100 times larger.
Yeah. Well, that's remarkable. I don't think there are any constraints, from the overall normalization. On the other hand, if you get features instead, then you can look for features in the power spectrum. And that's also another interesting signature.
Yeah, yeah. So I'll also talk about this later, but if you have like a quantum production of heavy particle, you don't get any feature in terms of momentum, but you get a 1/m² amplitude, which was 1/m², like
the additional amplitude. Yeah, well, that's fine. Okay, so there is I see.
Yeah. So
I don't think that you have this bound. Yeah, if it's just overall rescaling of the power spectrum, I don't see what's the problem.
Yeah, yeah. I'm just trying to remember if we had like some other reason that we wanted to be safer. Yeah, as far as I can think, I don't think it gives any special. It doesn't have any special. It doesn't give any special features. So
what just about the slope? Yeah, maybe the slope. So what's the slope of the power spectrum? Does it remain? Can you make it?
Oh yes.
Right?
Yeah, I think that's a good point. So maybe. Yeah, I haven't actually calculated, so I don't know. But maybe that would be a good reason. That would be a better way to constrain it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
okay.
I agree. Yeah.
Thanks.
Okay. So this is the main result of the work. So on x-axis I have the mass in terms of Hubble. On y-axis I have this amplitude of the non-Gaussian signal and non-analytic signal. That's what we're interested in. And I have plotted it for various values of chemical potential. It could be starting from 10 Hubble to 60 Hubble. And we see that we can see masses all the way up to the lambda that I've chosen. Right? For 10, I can see masses till 10, 20, and 40, 60. So I get the whole range of masses up to lambda. And the magnitude is as expected between like 0.1 to 10. And again, it could be more if that I'll check. But this is like a conservative choice. And one point to note is that it's above the sensitivity or the cosmic variance limited sensitivity of LSS and 21 centimeter.
Yeah, my comment on that. So about LSS, I doubt that perhaps too optimistic this forecast.
Yeah, it could be.
Yeah, one thing which it does not take into account, for example, is the damping of these oscillations, similar to BAO damping. Like we have BAO damping due to large bulk flows. So here there will be also kind of damping which limits the reach of this kind of analysis. But I think that may be very at least at this point it looks very optimistic, you know, that this sensitivity.
Anyway, like CMB constraint said to be less than like 50, so you have to live below that anyway. Now that I'm thinking, I guess it is a little optimistic.
No, I understand. That's that's not your work, but just a comment here.
And for 21 centimeter, does this mean this like futuristic, you know, from the moon kind of 21 centimeter, or do you mean something more like Chang?
No, I think probably.
Like, does this mean, you know, studying structure at like redshift of like 50 or 100? I mean, as opposed to redshift of like 1 or 2?
Oh, no, I think it would be the moon kind of experiment where you're studying it at much higher redshifts.
I see. Okay.
Yeah. But I think the 21 centimeter, I think the more relevant one is LSS. If this optimistic limit can actually be probed, then we are
about
that.
So this number, so this line, this 10 to the minus 1 or whatever line that you've drawn for LSS, that comes from assuming some sort of range of k's, I guess, that are being probed. And like, did you recall what you used for that?
Oh, actually, so I, this is, yeah, coming from the these works that I've referenced here. So it's not my projection as such. So I'm not completely sure about the details in like what kind of assumptions they make. But
like, but it's just like mode counting, I guess. I mean, like, presumably, like, and this one's gonna be, I guess you're counting like 1,000 squared modes.
So you have to count modes and then determine what's the cosmic radiance, and that would set the limit.
So then I'm puzzled then how you get such a huge improvement from LSS, right? Just because like the number of modes is similar. I mean, well. Like,
oh, because it's a 3D.
Sure.
Because you have a 3D map.
I understand, like, you know, but if you count just linear modes, you know, the number of linear modes is similar for a large scale structure and for the CMB, right?
I guess then there is probably an assumption of being able to like backtrack to get primordial non-Gaussian, like the non-linearities can be modeled.
I think this assumes you take all modes, including non-linear ones. I mean,
and
I don't know where, but that's why. But I think that's over optimistic, you know.
Although, I mean, if CMB hasn't seen anything at 50, and we do, if we want to prove non-Gaussian, I think one has to figure out how to kind of take into account non-linear.
That's for sure.
Still get primordial non-Gaussian.
Right. No, that you have to take into account anyway, even for those modes that are almost linear, but non-Gaussian is a smaller factor.
I see, okay. But if your factor is like 1,000, I guess, going from the blue line to the red line, I guess you're saying that you're going like a factor of 10 past K non-linear. So it's like K of 1 or so, I guess. That seemed kind of hard.
I mean, most of the works on non-Gaussianity, at least in the non-analytic, the detection of these heavy fields, I mean, they go even more optimistic at 10 to the power minus 3, 10 to the power minus 4 in FNL. And from that point of view, I think I'm being conservative in something. But not from the experimental point of view. another comment is, so you kind of have this kind of plateau like behavior, and once your mass goes above the chemical potential, then again you run into the same problem that you don't have enough energy to produce these particles, so you expect an exponential suppression. And it has this specific form. The shape of the non-Gaussianity has oscillatory features as expected. One interesting thing though is that because our frequency depends on lambda, the difference of lambda and mass, as the mass increases, the frequency of oscillation actually decreases, which is kind of opposite to what you would expect if you didn't have any chemical potential, if you just had the mass. So it kind of flips the intuition. And then the natural question is there a way to independently determine lambda and m so that I can actually extract the mass of this heavy field? And the answer is yes. There's a very interesting way in which you can extract this frequency. And it is by noticing that the frequency of oscillation is actually a function of the momentum ratio, which I'll call the squeezing parameter P. And a kind of intuition for that is as I said, the non-analytic signature is coming from the propagation, and the time difference between a time difference of the propagation actually depends on this momentum ratio log P. So in chemical potential, what happens is if I have been taking the limit that the squeezing parameter is very large, that means my P is actually very large and the field is propagating for a really long time. So when it decays, it's actually, its momentum has redshifted. So its energy or its frequency is just dominated by mass. So at decay, it's non-relativistic. And hence the information about it, its mass can be imprinted in the non-Gaussianity. But I can also imagine reducing the P, not keeping it, taking not really squeeze triangle, but at moderate squeezing. I can have a regime in which the particle doesn't actually get to propagate that much and decays earlier. And when it decays, it's still relativistic. It hasn't, its momentum hasn't redshifted enough, which means that through its propagation, it was never relativistic. So it's the information about its mass is not relevant and doesn't get imprinted on the non-Gaussianity. And because of this feature, what happens is if I ask what is the frequency of this oscillatory feature as a function of the squeezing parameter P, at really large P, I get this lambda minus M kind of frequency, which is what I was talking about before. But if I stick to some moderate P regime, then my frequency just depends on the lambda and there is no mass information. So this can be seen in this plot where I have basically the yellow line is the expectation from moderate P regime. The green line is the expectation in the highly squeezed limit, lambda minus M frequency. And you see that the blue dot, which is the actual dependence, smoothly varies from one regime to the next. And if I look at this moderate P regime, I'll extract the value of lambda from the oscillations. And if I look at the large squeezing parameter, I'll get lambda minus M. So I'll be able to get both lambda and M if I extract the oscillation frequency as a function of P. And this is very interesting because this feature is only there in chemical potential models. Because if you only have a heavy field, the heavy field is generally always in the non-relativistic regime and your oscillation frequency is always M. So you don't have these two regimes which having an extra energy scale lambda allows you. Another point I wanted to make is that even though my guess is this feature is common to all chemical potential models, but we saw it first because we could do the exact calculation and actually study non-Gaussianity in this moderate P regime. And generally with spin half and spin one cases, the non-Gaussianity was at loop level, which is difficult to do. And you have to do an approximation where you take large P and you generally only study the signal in the large P limit where you wouldn't kind of see this feature. So that is, I think, pretty neat because this gives you a way to independently determine chemical potential as well as the mass of the heavy field. So some comments. I described this this mechanism in complex scalars taking like a linear symmetry breaking term, and the U1 symmetry was only broken by this term. But you can very well have two scalars which have similar masses, and the symmetry breaking is done through the symmetry breaking, the difference in the masses. As long as this quadratic symmetry breaking term is smaller than the mass, the analysis kind of works the same way, but now you have to work at loops. So it can be, it's not like you have to stick with a linear symmetry breaking term. And wanted to point out some differences between our model and the previous studies. So in the spin half case, of course, you can do a similar thing where you couple the current to the derivatively to the inciton and you have a symmetry breaking term. In the case of spin halves, the symmetry breaking term is also the mass term. So the analysis is a bit different. And it so happens that there is no plateau-like behavior. So you always have this exponential suppression. So you can only probe masses of order square root lambda and not, you don't get the full range from up till lander. So the range is actually smaller in spin half case. And here are some references where this work is done. And in the spin one case, there is another problem where generally these heavy spin one plates are actually produced in overabundance. So to avoid any back reaction, you have to kind of take the mass to be very close to lambda. So that's kind of which we don't have in our case. You can have the mass from zero to lambda anywhere and not have this problem. Yeah, and the last part, which I also mentioned before, that I think one advantage is that we could do the calculation exactly, which is very difficult to do if you have loop diagrams. And one advantage was already that we could see the change in the frequency as a function of p, which gave us a way to actually independently determine lambda and m. Okay. So this takes me to part two. Any questions on part one? Okay. So
I have a question that is like perhaps a pre-question. So have you guys given any thought of a model that would naturally make the mass close to Hubble?
Oh, yes. Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of, I don't think I have it here, but there are a lot of papers where, I mean, mostly before this chemical potential mechanism was there, I think people recognize that you have to have the mass close to Hubble. So many papers actually tried to naturally explain why the mass should be close to Hubble. And one is just the quantum corrections to any, like if you have a scalar, the quantum corrections should be of order Hubble. So the mass can be naturally close to Hubble scale. So that was one way.
I don't understand that statement because, I mean, for example, if you have a scalar and you couple it, the quadratically divergent corrections, why is it just of order Hubble?
Oh, no. Okay. I shouldn't say it. Can you say that again?
No, I'm just asking the general question. What ensures, for example, I'll tell you why, because, for example, I know, as you know, like, he's there, like Jun Wu, Anson, and Davide had this paper where they were looking at the chemical potential for a spin one half. And there it was nice because they had it was the standard model fermions that were, because the standard model fermions were spanning several orders of magnitude in energy, you could imagine that by accident, you found yourself close to one of those resonances.
Okay.
So there they had the natural way to say why there was a state close to Hubble. So I'm asking if there is a similar thing you can do for this guy.
I think it's kind of, the point is the other way. It's like, if you don't have any prior expectation of the mass being close to Hubble, then you would be completely restricted. You won't be able to probe any higher masses. So we want to extend the range so that you don't have to be close to Hubble by accident or by any mechanism. You can be like an order of magnitude larger in mass than the Hubble's lens, still be seen at the in the non-Gaussian entities. So I'm not sure if I'm answering.
Yeah, it's okay. We can talk about. Please carry on. I don't want to interrupt your talk. Thank you.
Okay.
Before you go on, let me just point out we just hit the 1 hour mark. So maybe this is a good place to stop if people have questions. For me, it's fine if you want to continue with the second part, but if people have to leave and they have questions now, so. No one? Okay. Then, yeah, please go ahead.
Okay. Okay, so the second part is shorter, I promise, because it's ongoing work, and I'll just quickly go through some of the main parts. In the second part, the motivation is that to get rid of the Boltzmann suppression, you can have a classically produced heavy field. You can have a classically coherently oscillating heavy field, which wouldn't have any suppression. So imagine there is some heavy field in the field space gets kicked at some special time DC during inflation, and then it oscillates around its minimum and kind of dilutes with the inflation. And such kind of kicking and onset of these oscillations can come through various mechanisms. One is that you could imagine like a intermediate waterfall, like in hybrid inflation, but instead of ending the inflation, it just settles into new minimum and start and keeps slow rolling in that minimum, or which is kind of this first case. Or you can have this field excited through sudden turns in the field, in the trajectory. Like imagine of you're flowing in this direction and then there's a sudden turn. So there are oscillations in the heavier direction. And if a heavy field is excited classically like this, then of course there is no Boltzmann suppression. You have these pop particles already there just to decay to inciton. So that's another way to get rid of Boltzmann suppression. Another interesting part is that if you have such classically excited heavy field, then you can actually get cosmological collider signal at a power spectrum level, at a two-point function. You don't have to go to three-point functions. In fact, if you want this non-analytic signature at two-point function level, then you almost have to consider some kind of a classical oscillation, coherent oscillation. And there's a simple reason behind it. Just as we saw that in a three-point function case, time translation and the spatial scaling being the symmetry meant that the propagation time always depends on the momentum ratio, right? But, it's 1/m. But in two-point function, there is no non-trivial momentum ratio. So there is no dependence coming from this phase and the time difference being a function of momentum. So you don't get any this non-analytic signature at two-point function level if the particle is like produce through quantum fluctuations. So one way out of this is that you break the time translation symmetry and you have a special time at which this field starts oscillating. Then you can hope to have some feature at the two-point function level. Of course, to see the signature, you have to decay this heavy field into some light fields. I'll call it chi. You can think of it as the inciton, in which case you'll get features at the power spectrum of CMB, for example. A quick intuition is in this diagram. So you have a special time now, which is TC. So the field starts oscillating at this time. The oscillation, the start time is fixed, but the time at which it decays to fluctuations with certain momenta k, now that depends on the time because it depends on this frequency matching or resonance condition. It simply says that when the physical momenta of the outgoing mode matches the mass of this heavy field, the mass will decay into them. So which means that the time difference again depends on momentum through this log k behavior, and we would expect to see this non-analytic cosmological collider like signature, but now at two-point functions. Of course, you still have the ratio of momenta, but it's there is a special momentum now, which is kc, which is the first mode that gets produced when the field starts oscillating. And here in the right-hand side, I'm just showing how the feature would look like in the two-point function. It will start at some momentum, as I said, the first momentum that gets produced. And it will it will have this oscillatory feature which depends on the mass, and it will also dilute because the heavy field which is oscillating is also diluting due to inflation. So it will have some fall off in k space and oscillations. So this is the kind of signal you expect. So if I think that this guy or this light field that I was talking about is actually the inflaton, then I would expect these features in the two-point function, and this kind of work is done, and such signals are being checked, have been checked in Planck data, but no such features have been found till now, which means that there is constrained, they're constrained to be less than a few percent in the power spectrum. So, but then we can ask, what if Chi is not the inflaton, but some other light field during inflation, which gets large features, these non-analytic features. But now if this spectator field also decayed to standard model, then we would have to make sure that it doesn't contribute to the isocurvature, which would again dilute our features. So we don't want to actually decay to the standard model. What we can do it, we say that this light field actually reheats to some other dark sector, which preserves this large feature. And then we need some messenger which will bring this large features to us. So we need some another CMB-like map, which will record this feature in its own in its own power spectrum. And
excuse me, Arusha, can I ask a quick question about it? So you said, I have in mind that this TC is occurring quite after the CMB modes have left the horizon, right?
Sorry, can you say that again? I didn't quite catch.
Sorry, maybe my connection is not great. I was saying that TC, I would expect that the moment when this feature happens, that the mass of the field is changing, happens after the CMB modes have left the horizon.
Oh, no, no. I mean, so this TC has to happen such that it has to fall within the CMB window.
Okay. Yeah, then I understand the point about isocurvature. Okay, thanks.
I mean, it could happen later as well. It's just the model that we are thinking about, these, if it, the map, the kind of map we are thinking, it would also show up in these more overlap with CMB, so I have to worry about Planck constraints.
Okay. Thanks.
So as I was saying, that we need another kind of messenger or map which would have these large features, and one such map could be the stochastic gravitational wave background. So a kind of schematic, very simple schematic, is that inflaton reheats standard model dark matter as usual, but the spectator field chi actually reheats some dark sector which is not interacting with the standard model or dark matter. And there is some first order phase transition in that sector, which gives me stochastic gravitational wave background. And after this first phase transition, the dark sector then again merges with standard model dark, standard model sector, so that we have no isocurvature constraints anymore. And then there is effectively CMB. So basically, this gravitational wave, because it's coming from this extra stream, it can be uncorrelated with the CMB and just act as a completely independent map of its own, which carries information about the primordial fluctuations of chi, which have the information about this oscillating heavy field sigma. So that is kind of the flow. And this kind of model was studied in this paper. And they studied if the gravitational waves and the anisotropy would be visible. So you can look at this reference for more specific model. And I'll just give one kind of proof of principle that something can be very much visible in this another map, but can be completely hidden in CMB. So if I consider that, let's say in this new map, I have enough sensitivity in my experiments to actually get the anisotropies up to some reasonable value of L modes. And my only kind of noise is coming from cosmic variance, which is relevant at because I'm looking at L's of order less than 100. So cosmic variance does matter. So in that sense, I have considered a benchmark point where the amplitude of these oscillations in, let's say, gravity wave map is like four orders of magnitude bigger than it can be in CMB. So you can see that in the gravitational wave map, the mass of order 10 Hubble here can be seen very easily, while in CMB, it can be just completely hidden behind the cosmic variance. So these are just kind of fake maps that are produced by intersecting with cosmic variance. Let me know if there are any questions. I'll just kind of move a little fast. I just want to say that one could say that, is this signal even visible in gravity waves? Well, for some, I just showing here that for some benchmark points, you can actually have the signal being larger than the sensitivity of BVO. Now I know that's super optimistic, but it's just kind of a proof of principle that something potentially visible in gravitational wave can carry large features which are completely not, hidden in CMB. And just to finish, I'll say that the sensitivity, of course, if you have a binned data, you can get sensitivity to a larger parameter space. So here on the right-hand side, I have mass of this coherently oscillating heavy field. And on the y-axis, I have the strength or the amplitude of this oscillatory signal. And the blue region is the region that will be observable in this new map, which is gravity wave, but will not be visible in CMB. The green part is where you don't even need binning. Like you can literally see by eye because it's the signal to noise ratio L by L is just bigger than one. And just to show how the binning helps, I have taken one point in this blue region where naively, if I just look at the data, it looks like a scatter, but if I do some clever binning, you can actually see the oscillatory feature well. I'm sure there are much better ways to do this analysis and extract this data, but this is just kind of to give you the feel of an example where you can have large features in new maps and not have them in CMB. So finding new maps could be very, very potentially exciting. Okay, so I'm just going to end with some work that is in progress. So based on the first part of the talk, we are trying to generalize this chemical potential mechanism to the case of spin 2. And some challenges can be that the EFT cutoff is generally closer to the mass of the spin 2 case, where if you remember in the spin, in our case, we wanted like a hierarchy of scales, like the lambda being bigger than M being bigger than Hubble. So getting that hierarchy in the spin 2 case is a bit of a challenge. So we're working on that. Based on the second part of the talk, one thing that we are exploring is if it's possible to build a model where you can get much larger gravitational wave signal or much larger anisotropy in this signal so that you can see the features in much greater parameter space. And the last thing that we are thinking about is like if you already have this independent map, a gravity wave map, which can be potentially uncorrelated with CMB, can you think of some interesting physics that shows up in the cross correlation of these two maps, which would otherwise not be seen in if I just have a CMB or just have a gravity wave map? So these are the three directions we are currently exploring. And thank you so much for your attention. I'm sorry I went over time. I'll take if people have any questions.
Yeah, thank you so much, Lucy. Mm-hmm. I appreciate the details in the talk, so thank you. Do we have any questions from the audience? So we already had some discussion in the middle. Yeah, go ahead.
I have one. So remind, so what was limiting the chemical potential in the scalar case? So why you could not go above 60 Hubble?
Oh, yeah, that's a good question. So basically, if you remember, like when in the chemical potential, you have energy of order lambda. So when you produce this heavy field and inflaton fluctuations, they're produced with energy of order lambda. Right. So if the chemical potential is actually greater than the kinetic energy, then the whole perturbative aspect of the like analysis just breaks down because you're actually producing fluctuations which have more energy than the background kinetic energy now. So in order to maintain that...
So I mean, you destroy the background then?
Yeah, yeah. But so we don't want to...
So you destroy homogeneous background, you get large... Do you destroy inflation then, or what?
Even if you don't fully destroy inflation, you could get corrections in slow roll parameters, right? Like, and then that is constrained to be. But you're saying.
Yeah, in principle, if I get some different slow roll parameters, okay, fine, I can.
I think you lose like perturbative control, like.
The main point is that. Yeah, I think Oli is right. I think.
Well, it was in your slide. Yeah, earlier.
I only kind of mentioned it that we want a good kind of expansion in this del phi over lambda squared. So your cutoff has to be smaller than the square root of kinetic energy of inflaton thing.
Yeah, because you see, maybe that's true, but it's not super obvious because, well, after all, the whole thing is dominated by potential energy, not by kinetic energy of inflaton. Yeah, and that doesn't go anywhere. I mean, it's not destroyed. It's still there. Yes, so I still have some inflation, I think.
Oh, yeah, but...
So true that I will get large corrections perhaps to the power spectrum, maybe, but that again can be interesting instead of being maybe a feature, not a bug.
True. Maybe that's something to think about. We wanted to keep perturbative control, so we kept the. I'm still not sure if.
Yeah, Sergey, like Leonardo would agree with you. Like when we were doing this, like you will get like all kinds of higher dimensional operators of like DeFi.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is like, basically like, is that going, are you going to like resum into something that is nice?
Yeah.
Otherwise, like, you need to think like you are working in a theory where like the inflaton itself is somewhat strongly coupled.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I see.
It might be a problem, it might not be.
Yeah, I see.
Yeah, true.
Yeah. Yeah, the real bound is like when the suppression scale is out of Hubble. At that point, you know like your inflaton has to be composite.
When which scale is over the Hubble?
Like the suppression scale, should take it to be like square root of phi dot, right?
Uh-huh.
That suppression scale can go all the way to Hubble.
That's right.
And at that point, like the inflaton has to be composite.
Mm-hmm. I see.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I had a question. Why is there an easy way to understand why there one would expect cross correlation between gravitational wave and CMB?
It's more like rather than expecting, it's more like can there be something that can imprint in these cross-correlations, which is generally smaller in one of them? Or can it be used as an additional probe? Of course, there are cross-correlations that develop after when the gravitational waves is propagating to us. But I'm talking about the primordial cross-correlations. So one simple example would be if this heavy field that was oscillating, instead of decaying, if it had a coupling such that it decays to an inflaton and this extra chi field, let's say it has odd parity and the chi also has odd parity. So you only have these interactions where if you decay to inflaton, you have to decay to chi as well. Then you can expect that the signal is actually larger in the cross correlations. While if you want to get it just in CMB, you need two vertices. So you have an extra suppression.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just kind of an example where something can be in cross correlations, but it's smaller in individual maps.
I see. Thanks. Any other questions? If not, then we can thank Arushi again. Thanks so much for the talk.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.